are listening to Teacher Toolkit, supporting teachers, parents and students worldwide.
When we're having these conversations with our colleagues, is that we've got to be both robust and kind. And I'm arguing that the kindness really ought to come first, and then we're able to be pretty robust in our conversations.
We help teachers thrive and survive with classroom ideas, cutting-edge school resources, and research-informed teacher training materials. You will also hear discussions on the policy, guidance, and research-based publications.
This is Holly, editor at Teacher Toolkit, the most influential blog on education in the UK. The 2018 anniversary of the centenary of some women winning the right to vote in the UK inspired us to launch the 100 Women podcast series, in which we are interviewing 100 women working in the field of education or in the public eye in order to catalogue their lives, celebrate their successes, discuss the challenges they face, and discover what they would like to pass on to the next generation.
In this week's podcast, you can listen to the interview I did with Mary Meyer, school improvement consultant and author. Now, you have to bear with us a bit this week. The sound quality isn't brilliant, as Mary and I were chatting over Skype. However, it really is worth listening to, because Mary is so dynamic and offers so many pearls of wisdom and funny anecdotes in the 20 minutes that we chat, including three really great practical tips for how to creatively implement the curriculum to enrich teaching in your school.
This is Holly, editor at Teacher Toolkit, the most influential blog on education in the UK. And today I'm fortunate enough to be interviewing Mary Myatt. Hi, Mary.
Hello there. Hello, Holly.
How are you?
Yeah, really well, thank you. Really well.
Good. So can you introduce yourself to our listeners and tell them what you do and where you do it?
Yes. So my name is Mary Myatt. And what I do is essentially I work in schools talking to pupils, teachers and leaders about learning, leadership and the curriculum. And I do that really all over the country. And in order to clarify my thoughts about what I've seen, I then write about it. And some of that writing gets turned into books.
Right. And so what's your education background and the career path that led you to where you are now?
Well, my education background is that my degree was in classics in Latin and Greek. And when I decided to come into teaching in my 30s, I used the Greek philosophy as a springboard to study religious education, along with being able to teach some Latin and Greek. And then when I started teaching, it was mostly the RE, and I taught a bit of Latin just at lunchtime clubs and things. And I've also taught some English and some history and a bit of maths. And then after I had taught for about 10 years, I joined the local authority in Suffolk and was working on various projects, including school improvement across primary and secondary and special schools. And then the last few years, I've been independent, working in all sorts of schools and including some FE work as well. Up until about a year ago, I was two or three times a term, I was on inspection teams. So I did that for about 6 years, but I'm now just as an invited guest into schools.
Yeah, and what did your work as an inspector teach you?
People, for the most part, want to get better, but they don't deliberately set out to do rubbish work. And so I think that's probably the main thing it taught me. In terms of my own professional work ethic, it helped me to refine the fact that we need, when we're having these conversations with our colleagues, is that we've got to be both robust and kind. And I'm arguing that the kindness really ought to come first, and then we're able to be pretty robust in our conversations. And that we should expect that for ourselves as well as often, you know, that to other people.
Really great adjectives there to use to describe that. And it must have offered you a really good perspective to, now you're working with schools, to have worked on kind of both sides.
Yes, it has.
And what would be your favourite part about working with different schools?
I think the favourite part is every time I go into school, I realise, I'm reminded of the fact that every school is as individual as the people who work there and learn there. And so that's the magical thing about it. it's so obvious, but absolutely no two schools are the same. Mm-hmm. And I think what that means is that everyone in the sector has got a great deal to learn from everybody else in the sector. So, for instance, the school I was in this morning, they are in the top 1% of results for maths. They are absolutely phenomenal. Mm-hmm. But into the head, he knows that while the English, the literacy, the reading and the writing, they're well above national, but they're not in the top 1%. They're about the top 4-5%. And he knows that he's going to draw some ideas and some ways of working from another head teacher where they have absolutely nailed this, insofar as you can nail anything, but you know, where they're doing absolutely magical and deep work. And so it's this idea that people can be working at the top of their game but still realize that they've got stuff to learn from other people. Mm-hmm. And so I both take from that for myself, gain insights into really, really strong practice, but then encourage others to actually talk to one another about what is really buzzing in their practice and in their schools. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the best things about working with different schools is I'm quite often able to make those connections. Say, oh, you need to go and look at so-and-so's work and they need to come and watch what's happening here. And that's really affirming, I find. It's great to be able to make those observations.
Yeah, I bet it is. So what career achievement would you say you're most proud of?
I would say that it was the results that my students achieved when they were taking GCSE RE. Mm-hmm. And that's because everyone across the whole year group took a short course, and then those real keenies also took a full course GCSE. So some kids were getting a double dose of RE each week. Goodness knows what they were thinking. Anyway, what I found was that the students who were the most disaffected, who really didn't have a great attitude to school, whose prior attainment was not that high, but the progress they made, the residuals that they got on their results, it just gave me such a boost. I mean, they got those results, but I know I supported them to get there.
Yes.
And so I think that's the thing I'm most proud of.
Mm-hmm. That's really nice, especially as now, you know, you've gone on to do so many different things and then you look back and that's like a really big achievement you had. That's great. What would you say is the main challenge you face in your job now?
I think the greatest challenge I face is just trying to get everything done. Mm. There's so much interesting stuff to see, to talk about, to write about, to produce materials for, and it's about pacing, just pacing the process of that so that it is measured, so that there's a momentum behind it, but I think for me personally, that's one of the biggest challenges in my own professional work. But I think in terms of the challenge of the work that I do day by day in schools, I don't really see any, because I just find most people are so keen to learn and to take on board feedback and to welcome, you know, praise for stuff they're doing well as point is what they might do in the future. That the day-by-day work, I don't really see or encounter any difficulties because it's just so stimulating and people generally are so open.
So in your book recently, you wrote about how changes need to be made to the UK curriculum to increase achievement. Do you think the current curriculum isn't fit for purpose?
I think the current national curriculum is fine. I mean, we've got what we've got. It's what's done with it, I think, that is the problem.
Okay.
And, of course, the national curriculum is only part of the curriculum which a school offers to a child, but it is the nuts and bolts of what needs to be studied and encountered by all pupils and students. And I think where, as a sector, we've slipped up, I'm not talking about individual schools, but where as a sector we've slipped up is in the over-focus on English and maths results in primary and GCSE results in secondary, making sure that those are as high as possible. And so it's not been deliberate, but it's quite, that's happened. It's just people wanting to get the best results for their pupils and students. But in large parts of the sector, it's come at the cost and the price of a really rich curriculum in the wider subjects beyond English and maths in primary, particularly at Upper Key Stage 2. And in secondary, it's been an over-focus on exam technique, sometimes going right down into Key Stage 3. So what I would argue in terms of your question, in terms of responding to that, it's the way the curriculum is enacted that needs another big conversation around it. And of course, that is happening now nationally.
Yeah. And do you work with schools on that?
Yes, I do. I mean, as a result of the curriculum book coming out in June, quite a few schools have asked me to work with them and, you know, or collaborate with groups of schools. But the majority of my work at the moment in relation to the curriculum is actually keynote conferences and seminars and workshops to really to school leaders.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of advice would you give to a school who's struggling over that clash between, you know, what the curriculum's prescribing and how they want to enrich the curriculum?
The best advice I can give is to not try to do everything at once. And so in primary, if they are revisiting, say, the history curriculum at Key Stage 2, so getting some beautiful resources and artifacts and images of art and sources together, why shouldn't that be delivered across more than one year group? So if it was, for instance, a piece of work that was designed maybe for year four, why shouldn't the year three pupils have it and the year five if it's a brand new piece of work? Because what happens then is that the teachers, it's a form of CPD, as they talk about the planning, which they will have been able to do together, how it's been enacted in the classroom, and then the outcomes for the children, and the children talking about it as well. And so if you take things steadily like that, because then by the time the year threes and fours are ready for the next round of it, or the fours and fives, they will have had a chance to have built something else new, but they don't need to do it all at once, I think is one big advice I'm giving. The second big advice I'm giving, or strong piece of advice, is that really schools should be paying for their subject leaders, both in primary and secondary, to belong to the subject associations. Because lots and lots of resources are sitting there, lots of advice, also a great way to meet other people, and also to connect to the subject areas on Twitter as well, because again, lots of conversations are going around there. And then the third thing I think is one of the most efficient ways of cracking this open is to use a wider range of texts and stories to open up the curriculum. Mm-hmm. To use novels, to use adult accounts, for instance, of the Norman Conquest. There's one school, for instance, in Bristol, where the Year 7s for homework are reading extracts of Mark Morris's account of the Norman Conquest. And then in lessons, they're using Simon Schemer's account of the Norman Conquest. So all that's doing is it's showing them that there might be historical fact, but actually historians disagree about some of the implications of that. And normally, they're lucky to do it at A level. That's normally undergraduate work. But what that teacher's doing is exposing them to rich ideas, rich language, way beyond textbook stuff. And it's that kind of thing of going in really much deeper and in a more scholarly way that I think is possible both in primary and in secondary.
Mm, absolutely. Oh, that's really great advice. Thank you. So as I'm interviewing you for our 100 Women project, I wanted to ask what the centenary of some women winning the right to vote means to you.
Well, what it means to me is that we should never, ever take this for granted. Ever take it for granted. I mean, I regularly think that, you know, it is only 100 years, and that was for women, I think, if they were 30.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't come down to the same age as men for some years later. So this is such a short time ago that women did not have the vote. So just to cherish it, I think, to make sure that we never, ever take it for granted. And the price that those women paid in order to give us that gift of that freedom to vote. So, you know, they're the high profile cases. But actually, what's emerging this year in terms of the centenary is the people with lower profile at the time who are emerging as being real, you know, heroes and heroines in this story. A lot of people made huge sacrifices for women to have the vote.
Yeah, I agree. It's been great to read loads more accounts rather than, yeah, just, well, the brilliant famous ones as well. You're right. Okay, so we're just going to finish off with a quick fire round. If you hadn't become a teacher, what would you have become?
So I did consider becoming a lawyer or a barrister, but I just had a sneaking feeling I might have more fun teaching. And I have to say, I was right.
Yes. Okay, so now name three famous women, dead or alive, you would like to invite to a dinner party.
Well, the first one, they're all dead. And the first one is not famous, but she's famous to me and my family. And that is my Aunt Phil,
mm-hmm.
Who died about 20 years or so ago. But she was a shining light to me of being always enthusiastic about us as children, about our ideas and what we had to say, and always seeing possibilities in science and in the progress of mankind. And she was a complete inspiration to me, and I miss her very much. The second person I would like to have at a dinner party would be Clementine Churchill, because I think what she must have seen over the years of her marriage to Winston must have been extraordinary, and I think she had a huge amount to put up with him. I think they were devoted to one another, apparently. I just think she would be a really wise person.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last would be Vera Brittain, who wrote The Testament of Youth, and she's Shirley Williams's mother, and she lost her beloved brother, her fiancé, basically all her circle of male friends as a very young woman in the First War. So it ties in with the 100 years centenary of the suffrage as well.
Okay, and finally, which woman would you recommend that I interview next and why?
I'm going to suggest Kezia Featherstone.
Ah.
She is quite remarkable. Now, I've not seen her work in situ, but just seeing what she does for Women Ed and the work she does supporting other colleagues, I just think she exemplifies really grounded, humane leadership
mm-hmm.
with a dollop of sparkle mm-hmm. and lightness of touch. You know, she takes on some really big challenges, and I just think she's an absolutely fascinating leader.
I must make sure that I get that interview then. Thank you so much. And thank you so much for talking to me today, Mary.
Oh, it's been lovely, Holly. And lovely to catch up with you personally as well. So continue to enjoy Madrid, won't you?
I will do. Thank you so much.
You are listening to Teacher Toolkit. You can find out more about 100 Years, 100 Women on our website, teachertoolkit.co.uk, or follow us on social media using the hashtag TTKit100Women.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To continue the conversation, head over to www.teachertoolkit.co.uk and our social media channels to access all the links and resources mentioned on today's show. Why not share this with your colleagues and give them the gift of time, reduced workload, and increased impact? Until the next time, before you look after your students, look after yourself.